From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Russia's war on Ukraine continues to extract a horrible price in deaths, displacement, and human suffering. Many Ukrainian Americans have friends and relatives in harm's way, and even for those of us who don't, we too are feeling the financial costs of the war, with gas prices climbing to $4.60 a gallon across much of downstate Illinois. That's in part a response to President Biden's announcement yesterday that he would be stepping up America's economic response to the war by banning imports of Russian oil, coal, and natural gas.
Over the last 2 weeks, the Ukrainian people have inspired the world, and I mean that in a literal sense. They've inspired the world with their bravery, their patriotism, their defiant determination to live free. Putin's war has caused enormous suffering and needless loss of life. Women, children, everyone in Ukraine, both Ukraine and, I might add, Russians. Ukrainian leaders, as well as leaders around the world, have repeatedly called for a ceasefire, for humanitarian relief, for real diplomacy. But Putin seems determined to continue on his murderous path, no matter the cost. Putin's now targeting cities and has been targeting cities and civilians, schools, hospitals, apartment buildings. Last week, he attacked the largest nuclear power plant in Europe with an apparent disregard for the potential of triggering a nuclear meltdown. He has already turned 2 million Ukrainians into refugees. Russia may continue to grind out its advance at a horrible price, but this much is already clear. Ukraine will never be a victory for Putin. Putin may be able to take a city, but he'll never be able to hold the country. And if we do not respond to Putin's assault on global peace and stability today, the cost of freedom and to the American people will be even greater tomorrow.
By many accounts, Russian President Vladimir Putin expected a relatively easy walk into Ukraine, but it has not gone according to plan. Instead of embracing the Russian army as liberators, Ukrainians have by and large united in opposition to the invasion. At this point, it's hard to imagine an ending to this conflict that will be acceptable to Putin, the West, and to the Ukrainian people. In order to get a better understanding of where the invasion stands today and where it came from, I wanted to talk with someone who had deep experience in the region. Ian Kelly began his career in the U.S. Foreign Service in the last years of the Soviet Union and was involved in the establishment of American embassies in the newly independent post-Soviet countries. He later worked with NATO and was director of the Office of Russian Affairs in Washington. President Obama named him U.S. Representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and later ambassador to Georgia, another country that was once part of the Soviet Union and has had a troubled relationship with Russia. Today, Ian Kelly is ambassador in residence at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and he joins me now. Ambassador Kelly, welcome to the 21st show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you recently signed a letter with nearly two dozen other foreign policy experts calling for a limited no-fly zone over Ukraine. Why is that important?
Well, I think the pressure to do more to protect innocent civilians from bombardment from Russian forces is going to become very, very intense. I don't see how we can stand by and watch the murder of civilians, watch civilians slowly run out of food, medicine, and have no access to water or power. We're seeing that in a city called Mariupol right now. Mariupol is about one-tenth the size of Kyiv, and it's clear to me that Kyiv is next. So I and some of my former colleagues and associates have called for setting up a safe haven, very limited, in areas where the Russians are not operating, which is really, you know, about two-thirds of the country. So I just see this as inevitable. I don't see how the Western community can just stand back and watch innocent civilians being murdered or starved.
So I hear you that there's a lot of nuance, and reading the letter, you can see that it's not just a blanket no-fly zone over all of Ukraine. I think there are still people who hear this and they worry about that, though, that you have someday an American pilot shooting down a Russian pilot. The Washington Post columnist Max Boot drew a historical analogy. He wrote, "The United States wisely resisted that temptation during the Cold War, even when it meant standing by and watching Russian tanks snuff out rebellions in Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968. The same calculus applies today," he said. I wonder what you think of that argument and that concern that this could lead to hot conflict, so to speak, between the U.S. and Russia.
I think it's not the best analogy. In 1956 in Budapest and 68 in Prague, what we were talking about then is actually using military force to stop tanks to become directly involved in a shooting war with Russia. What we're talking about here is taking a part of the country where we can create a safe haven. Make it clear to Russia that our designs there are to protect civilians, and we have no intention of becoming engaged with Russian forces. So I think that's a very, very big difference from inserting ourselves directly in a war.
I'm glad you framed that as in the context of being a historical analogy, because this is analogies at war often do guide responses, and they can also be quite dangerous, right? There's a book of political science on this that talks about how the memories of the failure to stop Hitler in 1938 led to America getting stuck in the quagmire of Vietnam, when it would have been a better analogy to look at the French experience in Vietnam, which might have told us what we were in for. What is your best understanding of a historical analogy for what's happening in Ukraine today to help us understand how we should be responding?
Well, I think, a lot of people are really surprised that the Europeans who, especially the Central Europeans like the French and the Germans, have joined in these very robust, in many ways, economy-killing sanctions. And I think the main reason for that is they want to stop an irredentist power. An irredentism is a country claiming another country's land as its own historical territory. This is exactly what Putin is doing with Ukraine, and it's exactly what Hitler did in 1938 with Czechoslovakia. So I think that the reason why we've been able to get such unity with Europe, and even had previously neutral countries like Switzerland and Sweden join in sanctioning Russia and supporting Ukraine, is a sign that our allies really are serious about stopping Putin.
An irredentist power, that's an interesting phrase. This is, I think, the idea you're getting at there that Putin has is this talk of Ruski Mir, right? This idea of the Russian Empire predating even the Soviet Union. How do you understand Putin's motivations?
Well, I think he basically said what he was going to do back when he said the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I'm not saying that he wants to recreate the Soviet Union, but
like he may want to go back even further, right? I mean, he holds meetings and rooms with statuary of the czars and czarinas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think he, yeah, if he's looking for historical models, it's more Peter the Great than it is, Stalin or Khrushchev. You're absolutely right. But the tragedy that Putin saw was having 25 million Russians in December 1991 suddenly be outside the borders of Russia. So he has started a project of creating something he calls the Eurasian Union, where you have an organization that's Moscow-centric that brings into it countries where Russian speakers are, He has brought in Belarus and Kazakhstan. And if you look at where the Russian speakers are outside of Russia, there are three places. Belarus is one, Kazakhstan's another, but the place with the biggest number of Russian speakers is Ukraine. So this invasion is his attempt to militarily reclaim historically Russian territory, as he calls it. It's not subtle. He laid it all out in two speeches a couple of weeks ago before he gave the order to invade. And I think that's why the Biden administration and our European allies are taking this so seriously. He is intent on taking over maybe not all of Ukraine, but definitely installing a friendly Russian government in Kyiv.
Is he? There has been speculation that maybe he's, gone, I don't know what the technical term would be, off the deep end a little bit, right? I mean, he's putting his nuclear cards on the table. Is he still a rational actor, in your view?
I would say a month ago that he was still a rational actor. I think he's showing signs now of not being in contact with reality, with the economic reality that his country is facing, with the military reality that his armed forces are facing in Ukraine. So I am concerned about that. He does have a tendency to overreact to threats. So he has threatened to use nuclear weapons before. I think this is just a way for him to get inside our head and make us afraid to do anything to try and stop him. You have to take what he says seriously. But I will say one thing. He obviously is someone who doesn't mind using violence to further his aims, but he is not somebody who is suicidal. So he's homicidal, but not suicidal. And he knows that if he uses a nuclear weapon, that's the end of him and the end of his regime. So we should take it seriously, but we should also recognize that he's trying to get into our head with these dire threats.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce Ambassador Ian Kelly, who joins us this morning. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Ambassador Kelly was the ambassador to Georgia, a former part of the Soviet Union during the Obama presidency, also U.S. representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. He's presently ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. Again, 800-222-9455. You mentioned Putin and in terms of the information he's getting from on the ground, right? And I wonder, what is your understanding of the broader information environment in Russia today? The New York Times says it's removing its reporters over a law that effectively criminalizes accurate reporting. There have been reports of Ukrainians calling relatives in Russia and finding that they don't even believe that Russia has invaded. What is your understanding of what ordinary Russians know?
Yeah, that's a great question. There have been studies of where support for Putin is lowest, and it is always in places where there is internet penetration, broad internet penetration. In other words, places where people can get alternative sources of information that are different from the Kremlin's. As of right now, Putin, I'm afraid to say, really has set up a totalitarian information regime. He used to tolerate web-based media sites that would criticize him. He did not have a Chinese firewall against the West, as they do in China. But in recent times, he has criminalized criticism of the war up to 15 years in prison. And he has shut down the few low wattage radio stations and low circulation newspapers that he used to tolerate to give his country kind of a facade of a free press. So it's a very worrisome situation in terms of the information blackout, essentially. I understand that Russians can still get access to some of these Russian websites that are offshore mm-hmm. by using a VPN, but they're moving more and more to a Chinese model of control of information sources.
Okay. We're going to continue this conversation. We need to take a break. We're speaking with former U.S. Ambassador Ian Kelly. You're listening to The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Ambassador Ian Kelly. He is the ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. Previously, he was ambassador to Georgia, as well as U.S. representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. He was also once director of the Office of Russian Affairs in Washington and had a long career in the U.S. Foreign Service. 800-222-9455. If you want to join our conversation, we're talking about the latest with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as well as the historical roots of that invasion. 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. Before the break, we spoke about Putin and his motivations. What do you think of President Zelensky of Ukraine? Putin talks about a country led by drug-addled Nazis, and Zelensky's reviews before the war were mixed, right? Allegations of corruption. He showed up in the Pandora Papers, even cracking down on dissidents, but he appears to be quite sober and is, in fact, a Russian-speaking Jew who lost family in the Holocaust. Where did that line of propaganda come from? And just more broadly, what do you think of Zelensky?
Well, Zelensky is Ukraine's Churchill of 1940 by his use of inspirational language. His determination at any cost, including to his own self, to stay in Kyiv, and I don't think that Putin really I don't think he took this kind of global inspirational figure into account. It's really been quite extraordinary. Yes, I mean. The one of the war aims that Putin established was the denazification of Kyiv, and this is part of the myth that the false narrative that the Kremlin has set up in Russia itself for what is happening in Ukraine. Like any propaganda, any good propaganda, there's just a scintilla of truth to the idea that there are far right forces in Ukraine, and that comes out of the first battles in Donbas, where some of the first militia that showed up were far right Ukrainian nationalists. It's really quite ludicrous to claim that the head of this government is a Nazi. As you point out, he's Jewish and he lost family members in World War II.
It strikes me that Zelensky seems to have reawoken something in Western democracies, right? We've seen the rise of increasingly authoritarian leaders, or at least authoritarian curious leaders, in a number of Western democracies in recent years. And yet here he is talking about the commitment to liberalism, right? Not in the American political ideology sense, as you know, but this sort of broader idea of freedom and you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Do you see Western democracy, something turning there in the way they think of themselves and their role in the world in the 21st century?
Well, I think it has really awakened a lot of people in the West and Europe and the United States to the threats that unaccountable authoritarian aggressive powers represent to countries' sovereignty and independence and freedom to make their own choices. Because this is exactly what Putin is denying Ukrainians, saying you can't join the West, you can't join the EU, you can't join NATO. And I think Putin's done us all a favor by showing us that these are values that people are still willing to fight for and die for. These are really, really important principles that the Ukrainians are standing up for. And I have never seen NATO so united as it is right now. If we have Vladimir Putin anything to thank for, it's that we have unity, and we also have bipartisanship for the first time in many years in terms of the support for Ukraine on Capitol Hill.
We had a caller who didn't want to go on air but asked about Radio Free Europe, if that could be a way to get information to people in Russia and Ukraine. And I wonder, you can answer that. And I also just wonder in general about modern technology and reaching the Russian people. You talked a little earlier about areas with internet penetration. I have to imagine that this is an environment that you and your colleagues, when you were early in your career, could only have dreamed of, right, in the Soviet era. And I wonder how that has changed diplomacy. How has technology affected diplomacy? And how does reality in 2022 differ from, you know, what we might imagine it to be when this democratizing internet around the world?
Well, you know, I must admit, when I was in the Foreign Service and dealing with Russian issues, I was extremely frustrated at the asymmetrical information warfare that was being waged, at the, you know, the amount of money that Putin was putting into Radio Sputnik, as they call it, the infamous RT, which just absolutely dwarfed the money that we were putting into Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. That's changing. And although radio is in the title, it really isn't radio anymore. It's digital, and Russians do listen to it. They increasingly have to use a VPN to be, you know, a virtual private network to be able to listen to it. I think that you'll see this Cold War type information war really getting more and more important.
We're coming to the end of our time, and I want to ask if you can sketch out for us what an end to this might look like. Is there any hope for a situation that is acceptable to Putin and the West, and perhaps most importantly, to the Ukrainian people?
Yeah, I mean, I'd emphasize that last point. It has to be acceptable to the Ukrainian people. And It's difficult for me to see how Putin will stop military operation, as he calls it. It's a crime to call it a war, by the way, without having some kind of change of regime in Kyiv. So that is I think very disturbing, because that will mean, I think, a real escalation in the kind of shelling and bombing we see of Kyiv. But I frankly I can't see any Ukrainian politician accepting the terms that would render the capital of Ukraine into a Russian puppet regime as the one in Minsk is in Belarus. I do think that Putin only has a limited number, a limited amount of time to do what he has to do because of his economic situation. And I think money will start to run out. Half of their budget comes from oil and gas. And the U.S. has announced that we'll stop buying. I think you'll see other countries starting to do that. And that will make Putin more dangerous because he knows he has to act very quickly. But at the same time, I think his days are numbered.
Do you think his day, when you say his days are numbered, I mean, one of the things that seems to be motivating him is a fear of ending up like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and the leader of Libya, whose name I'm blanking on at the moment. But I mean, he reportedly watched the video of him being shot in a drainage ditch over and over again. Is there an end to this with Putin still in power?
I think, you know, that's for the Russian people to decide. I know that's kind of a glib answer. I don't think that we should be involved in any way in any kind of clandestine attempt to remove him. I think that'd be extremely dangerous and even counterproductive. But it's hard for me to see the people of Moscow and St. Petersburg putting up with this destruction of their engagement with Europe, and you know, their ability to travel taken away, their ability to get foreign currency taken away, rampant inflation, possible default on their external debt. It's going to lead to unrest. And whether or not it leads to a new government, I don't know. But again, it's up for the Russian people to decide.
Ambassador Ian Kelly is ambassador in residence at Northwestern University and the former U.S., or I should say he was once U.S. ambassador to Georgia and had a long career in the Foreign Service. Ambassador Kelly, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge today on the 21st.
Thank you very much.